Welcome to the Magic Beans podcast. We're here for episode number 2. We've come back again. I'm your host for today. My name is Shorty, and I'm joined again by a whole bunch of beans. So today we have an extra one. We have Chris. Chris, welcome to the podcast for the first time. How are you going?
I'm doing well. Good to be here.
That's good. That's good. And we're joined by the same crew as last week. So we have Scott, the Blaster Boy.
Hello.
G'day, Scott. Chewy. Chewy's back again.
G'day, Beans.
How you going?
Good, good.
That's the way.
Good to be here.
And of course, we have Cracker. How you going, Cracker?
Very well, thank you, boys. Good to be back.
That's the way. That's the way. So we got one under our belt last week, or a couple of weeks ago. It was a bit of fun. And now we're here again. We've actually made it to 2 episodes. We haven't just been the one and done, and we're out of here. So hopefully we can provide you with a bit more content for your listening pleasure. As a reminder, we are coming to you from Melbourne, Australia, so we hope that you enjoy our accents and hope that you can understand us, but we should have a few good topics for you today. So we're going to kick it off pretty quickly today, and we're going to kick it off with Chris with his origin story, seeing as he missed out last week. So Chris, if you want to give us a bit of a rundown, how'd you get into magic, all that sort of stuff, and go from there.
Sure thing. So my name's Chris. I was first exposed to magic when I was really young, like around 96, which may not be young for some people, but I was young then. And I was in primary school. I was playing Pokemon, and I can remember going to card shops because I was getting Pokemon cards, and there were these magic cards there. So that was sort of my first memory of magic. I think I even bought a booster pack or something, and to me it was just like an adult's version of Pokemon, so it was a bit too hardcore when I was 8 or 9 or something. And from there, I didn't really have any involvement with magic up until about 3 or 4 years ago, where I was actually chatting with Cracker about the fact that he played, and that sparked my interest. And then I reached out to some of you guys, so Chewy and Shorty, and had a bit of a chat. And yeah, just the whole concept intrigued me of a game that just looked really awesome to play. I was really into strategy games. I love playing RTS games. So anything that had a strategy element seemed really cool, something that you could develop and learn and get quite good at and play competitively also sparked my interest. And the collectability and purchasing and buying and selling cards also sparked my interest, which is something that I'm pretty into.
Pretty safe to say that hooked you in.
Yeah, collecting stuff is a bit of a hook. So I have procured a few cards in the short few years that I've been playing, but that is a really enjoyable part of the game too. So, I think the first boosters or cards that I bought was around Shadows Over Innistrad, Eldritch Moon. So I think that was 2016. And I think the first pre-release I went to was an Eldritch Moon pre-release, which some of you guys read as well.
Yes.
Yeah, and that was probably my first intro to Magic, and really steep learning curve, just getting my head around cards and mechanics and that kind of thing, which I know Scott is starting that journey as well. So be good to have you along and part of that as we go through and do a few more bits on the podcast. Just got started with some basic decks and playing some basic creature-based strategies, which is probably actually what I enjoy playing the most anyway. And, made my way along to playing at some FNMs and playing.
Do you remember your first deck, Chris?
I think the first deck I played at an LGS event was Modern, and I think I played Boggles, which for anyone who doesn't know is basically playing a creature that is hexproof, so it's got a certain element of protection and can't really be targeted, and you just buff it, make it really, really big, and just swing in for a lot of damage. So that seemed really, really appealing at the time. I remember borrowing cards from everyone I could. Shorty, I think you lent me some stuff.
I'm pretty sure you've returned the favor by now.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's where I started, and I got into Merfolk. So playing a Merfolk deck, again, in Modern. And I remember taking that to first GP I went to, which was in Sydney. And, yeah, that was cool. I ended up winning a side event there, which was kind of the first result of any form that I'd had, and that was pretty cool. And, yeah, since then I've been trying to get along to the few GPs that we get in Australia when we get the chance, usually in Sydney. We had one in Melbourne last year, which was awesome. And, yeah, like the rest of us, it's hard to squeeze in that sort of work-life magic balance. So, yeah, try and get to things where I can, but probably not as often as I'd like.
Yeah, pretty much the same as the rest of us in the same similar sort of boat. Poor on time, but definitely love the game.
Yeah, that's it. So I'm similar to some of the other guys. I'm married. I've got two kids who are under three. I have a job. I have a mortgage and all that fun stuff. So yeah, magic is definitely a passion, but it's also something that we need to try and squeeze in wherever I can.
That's right. And you mentioned the collectability side was a bit of a factor for you. And I know from knowing you that there's also the financial side of the cards. We mentioned it on the previous cast that there is a lot of buying and selling and money to be made through Magic cards. For people that don't know, you know, they might just see us playing this game with little kids' cards and things like that, but some of them are worth quite a lot of money. And there is actually the potential to use Magic cards as almost like a share market, stock exchange type thing. The values do go up and down based on how popular they are at certain times, what decks they're being played in and things like that. And I know, Chris, that's something that you like to keep an eye on. That's safe to say.
Yeah, for sure. I think similar to you, Shorty, one of the things that I really liked about the game is that there was intrinsic value in like the cards and a lot of the stuff that you bought into. So one of the things I think is really unique about Magic is the fact that there is actually value in the game and in the cards themselves. So I can't even think of any other game that you could sort of buy into, or even any other hobby that you can buy into and sort of retain the value or maintain some sort of value, short of something like, I don't know, a hobby with collectible cards or something, but that's pretty intense.
Yeah, I mean, other collectible card games like your Pokemon and that sort of stuff, they have what's called the secondary market, which is, you know, the Wizards of the Coast is the company that manufactures or makes Magic. They sell sealed products that come in booster packs. But once those booster packs are opened, what happens to those cards is they get sold on the secondary market. So local game stores, LGSs, as it was mentioned before, they will sell individual cards, or people on Facebook or on eBay and that sort of stuff. So there's a whole market out there, and other card games definitely do have that that sort of thing. But I think Magic is, for a game that's been around for 26 years or 27 years, however many years it's been out for now, it's shown that cards hold their value over that period or that length of time. And I think that's pretty rare. Like even things like, you know, basketball cards and baseball cards and things like that, other than a really small number of highly collectible cards, that they just don't hold their value. I know I was going through my collection of stuff when I was moving house just before Christmas and found my old Upper Deck cards from 93-94, which I'm sure probably some of you guys you remember that when it was the basketball craze.
Yeah, for sure.
And I thought, oh, you know, surely these are worth a bit of money, and you go and look them up and no, they're not worth anything. They just haven't held their value, whereas yeah, Magic cards definitely does. And I know you, Chris, you like to keep track of that stuff. I know you've got some pretty hardcore spreadsheets that you use to track your purchases.
Yeah.
You do quite a bit of what's called specking.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a numbers guy. And look, I casually spec or speculate. If I think a card's good, I might buy a few extra copies. And if it goes up in value, I can sell some. And sure, use that to fund more cards. That's what you end up doing.
That's right.
That's all of us do, man. You sell cards to buy more cards, right?
There's no,
I need to put petrol in the car. Forget it. I'll catch the bus.
it's all about priorities, right? But that's one of the really cool things. Like there is a whole collectible aspect to the game, and similar to other collectibles, like you were saying, Shorty, like basketball cards or whatever. That's cool, but like I like the fact that Magic is both collectible, but there's also utility and it's a game. Like you can't sit down and play a game of baseball cards, I don't think, anyway. I'm really not plugged into that.
But you haven't played those baseball games?
No.
Oh, man, that's the best game.
Yeah, so if you listen in the States, you'll probably be healing over laughing. But I love the fact that you can actually get a lot of fun and a lot of enjoyment out of it. And there's a lot of play to the game Magic, and deck building and all the kind of stuff that goes with it. And not only are the cards intrinsically valuable and collectible, but there's also utility, and there's a whole heap of fun to be had in actually playing with the cards themselves too. So I think the combination of all of those for me makes this game super unique, and that's what's really hooked me, and that's just what I love about it.
Yeah.
And we really like that you've got a good collection we can borrow.
I am here to help.
Yes, it's certainly come in handy. As we mentioned last week, we have travelled to a few tournaments together, and having a friend like Chris is pretty handy for borrowing cards and things like that. So, the finance side of it is a whole nother topic. We've got that on our docket for a future episode. And Chris, we will definitely be looking to you occasionally for some hashtag MTG finance, as it's known on Twitter and in the Magic world, to give us a bit of a rundown on what you think's going on. We will also, I think we'll spend a full episode or most of an episode at some point in the future discussing how we go about managing the cards, how we keep track of, you know, what we've purchased, what we're selling, when do we sell cards, when's the best time to buy cards, all that sort of stuff. So that's a whole nother topic, but like you mentioned, Chris, it's a similar situation to me, where that the fact that the actual Magic cards have some sort of value is definitely a good draw card, as well as being an amazing game to play. So welcome to the podcast, Chris. Hopefully you'll be sticking around for the long haul, and we'll be hearing from you every episode.
Sounds good.
And I'm sure you've got plenty to contribute to us. So with that out of the way, we're going to have a bit of an update from Scott. So if you remember from last week, Scott is our resident noob. He's the newest Magic player in our group, in our bunch of beans. And I wouldn't say... I don't know. Don't know what I'm trying to say, but the least experience.
I've got no idea what you're trying to say.
I'm going to get myself in trouble, and Scott's going to come over here and knock me on the head. Least experience, probably the best way to put it. But freely admitted of his own accord.
Yep.
So the aim, or one of the aims of this podcast, is to help Scott improve, and by helping Scott improve, we're hoping that we can help others out there who are listening improve their Magic play and finding the time to play and all those sorts of things. So we'll be checking in with Scott pretty much every week, just to see sort of how he's going, what he's been up to, how he's finding sort of getting into Magic a little bit more. So Scott, I believe you've been playing a little bit of Arena this week.
I have.
Finding that?
I'm actually really enjoying myself at the moment. I think as we've sort of talked about before, being a very time poor type of group that we are, and for those that don't know, I work in a division of an account section that end of financial year for us is always pretty tough. So this week I haven't had a lot of time to really play as much as I'd like, but I have delved into Arena and I've fired it up again for probably the first time in months. Pre-ordered my M20 core set and cracked all that open last night.
Did the same myself. That was good fun. Yeah.
And I was so determined. I thought, I'm going to move away from this whole red deck thing. I like a white deck that I've been playing recently. And then I opened this set of cards and thought, no, I think I'll go back to red now, because there's so many cards in there.
Well, Chandra is the main theme or main character, lead character for the newest set that's just been released, Core Set 2020.
And she does happen to be my favourite Planeswalker. So
there's three versions of her in this.
Three versions, yes.
I don't think you're going to be escaping your mono red for a while, Scott.
No, I think my white deck saw a lifespan of about 3 days, and that's about it. So by the time that I did have an arena was predominantly spent more around getting this mastery tree complete. I haven't finished it yet, but I'm almost there. And I think one of the good things from a new player perspective with that whole mastery tree is that you get a lot of free stuff out of it as well. So if you complete the tree and it's totally, then you do get a couple of extra sets of cards and decks put together. So that's nice to have.
Definitely a good draw card for brand new players coming into the game. For those, I can't remember exactly what it was like, but Magic Online, the old program that we don't speak about much anymore, that was almost impossible for a new player to get into. I believe you had to pay like $10 just to make your account. Is that right, Chewy? Do you remember that?
Yeah. It was $10 US to just make your account, and you got very minimal cards. And then you had to go to the secondary market then to get any cards or packs. And they have their own economy on there. So where there's tickets, which are one ticket equals one US dollar. And you could accrue those through playing games. But, yeah, you were effectively buying copies of digital cards at sometimes the same price that you would buy a physical card with. So, yeah, it was a barrier to entry for sure.
Yeah, and there was no actual way to earn free cards or free packs or anything like that from what I understand.
No, and certainly no tutorial linked in with that like Arena has. So it just expected that you knew the game at that point. So
And you could also navigate your way through the Windows 95 program to find out how to figure out how to play somebody and start a match and things like that.
I tried it once, and this is going back a long time ago, and I thought there's no way am I ever going to enjoy this style of game. And I think I probably gave it about 5 minutes. I thought nope. Just getting past that initial login phase was hard enough, but Arena makes it.
I'm sure we'll spend a whole topic on. Well, we will definitely have a topic on Arena coming up soon in the next couple of episodes, but I'm sure we'll spend a bit of time talking about the past and Magic Online and the differences and the benefits of going to Arena. But continue on with what you're saying about the Mastery Tree, Scott.
Oh yeah, just with the Mastery Tree, I just think that's a great thing for new players that are getting into it, and of course now they brought out the Core Set Mastery Tree as well. So, of course, I threw some gems onto that straight away because I know I can't.
I was having a look at that today, and I think we'll touch on that, just meowing
the whole time. You can change its color too. So
yeah, right, nice. I think when we get into our topics on Arena in the next few weeks, we'll spend a bit of time talking about that sort of stuff. But from what I saw of that today, it does seem like a good system. It's a new reward system for playing on Magic Arena. Previously there were rewards for completing your daily quests and getting daily wins and things like that, and they've now brought out a new system, so we'll see how that pans out over the next few weeks. But I think from what I saw of it today, for a new player, new to Arena, new player experience, it seems like a good way. It's kind of like the old, you play your RPGs like Diablo and things like that, where all you want to do is level up. And some of us, some of the members on this podcast, we are currently in the middle of a Pathfinder campaign. And I'm pretty sure the whole reason why we play Pathfinder and D&D and things like that is just to level up and up your stats and things like that. So that's all it's about. Who cares about the actual role playing? And sorry, Chewy. Chewy's running the campaign for us.
I had new voices lined up for next week. And costumes.
I want to hear them. Whoa, we're not about costumes. Actually, one of the guys in our group does bring a prop each week. So
yes, we won't talk about him. But, multiple
props.
It kind of gives that same leveling up experience with this new Mastery Tree system, where it's, you play a few games, you win a few matches, you go up in a level, you get a reward, that sort of thing. So it scratches that itch that all of us gamers and especially, role players and collectible card game players, we all love that sort of leveling up type thing.
The only negative thing I've got to say about the Core Mastery Tree, though, is I found that unlike the other mastery tree, the beginner's one, you do have the option with this to buy the XP to take you all the way through to level 100, I think it is, and virtually get everything in that ladder. And in an age where we're sort of going through that whole loot box fiasco and governments are now banning certain games in certain countries because of the whole loot box thing, I'm a little bit concerned that Wizards might be taking this as a bit of a cash grab to grab those people that think, well, I don't want to just level through and earn the stuff. They do give people the opportunity to buy it. And that worries me a little bit, that that might become a bit of a norm, especially if it becomes popular.
Yeah, and that's something that's definitely been discussed on other podcasts, that people want Wizards to be careful that they're not moving too much in that direction where they just put everything out there where people can just pay. It's not so much pay to win, but they're kind of bleeding people dry by just having these opportunities to spend money, because there are people that will do that. I'm not one of those people. I couldn't care less about cosmetics and things like that, but there are people out there that will spend their money on those types of things. And that's, at the end of the day, that's how they make their money. But if they push too far in that direction, then, that could be a little bit of a concern.
It could be a concern. Yeah, that's the only negative thing I can think of at the moment. But apart from that, I like the idea. And I certainly like the rewards that they offer as well. But I prefer to
earn it.
Here. But yeah, going forward, I think so. I've had a good couple of days so far. I think heading into the next fortnight, my plan is to try and move back into my red deck again and look at some of these new cards in the M20.
But How have you found playing with the mono white decks?
That's actually been good, and I should play with that more. Really, I shouldn't move away from it, because it's now you guys will know the deck a lot better than I would. I don't even know what it's called. I just call it the White Mono Lifelink deck. And it basically just evolves around putting certain cards down that are constantly generating tokens, and then those tokens generate lifelink, and so you're constantly getting your life up, but also damaging with flyers as well. And I'm not describing it very well at all, so I apologize. but it's been getting me some wins. I think I'm ranked 2 bronze at the moment on that deck. So
yep, nice work.
So I've had more wins on that deck than I have any other. But so I should give it more of a shot. But I think there's just too many cards in this M20 that's come out yesterday that I like that are red, unfortunately. So I probably will end up going back that way. But I would like to try drafting out. I think I spoke to you the other day about that, and you mentioned how the drafting process works, and I've never done that before, so I'd like to give that a go this fortnight.
Yeah, well, I think we will have a discussion on drafting, specifically arena drafting, which is a little bit different to real life in person draft. When you play in paper tabletop Magic, you sit down with 8 people, or if you can actually get 8 people together, which we struggle to a lot of the time. But ideally, it's 8 people sit down and you pass the packs around. And I think you've actually done that with us a couple of times, Scott.
Yeah, I have.
We've been into the city a couple of times. On Arena, it is a little bit different. You are drafting against bots. So the process is the same, but you're not drafting against other people, which can be a little bit different. It does lead to the possibility of exploiting the bots. The bots obviously run off of algorithms to determine what they're picking. And once people figure out, they rate these cards really low and these cards really high, you can exploit that. But I don't really pay too much attention to that. I'm not a very good drafter to start with, and for you starting out, you're not going to pay any attention to that sort of stuff. Yeah. But yeah, definitely we can run you through how that process works, and potentially we can look at, as we discussed before the cast, about getting together and recording that and putting that up on YouTube and that sort of stuff. So we'll get into that sort of thing a little bit more, and I think we caught up on the weekend. We were having a bit of chat about the economy of Arena and how to maximize your gems and your gold and things like that. But we'll go into that a little bit more detail on another cast. Anything else on what you've been doing lately, Scott? Or
no, that's about it. That's the blaster watch for this week.
Very good. I like it. Yep. So for the rest of us, we pretty much the other four guys on the cast, we all caught up about 2 weeks ago now down near Geelong and played a whole bunch of Commander. We were down there for something altogether, and we played a whole bunch of Commander, and that spawned a few more topics into our list of upcoming topics, mainly around politics in Commander and things like that. We had a few games that spawned quite a few arguments and people threatening to never play again and things like that. I think it was all in good fun, but it was good just to have a catch up and play some Magic, drink cups of coffee and tea and just have a good time. And we all mentioned it on the cast last week when we're doing our Origin stories, that's the thing we really enjoy. It's getting together, playing Magic and just having a good time. And it's the same when you go to tournaments, that sort of stuff as well. So other than that, I don't think much of the rest of us have done too much. I know, Chewy, you've put up another couple of videos up on YouTube.
Yeah, I've been trying to find time to get in some games where I can. I did do a draft, Scott.
Yeah, I watched that.
About drafting. Oh, good. Yep. For anybody who's interested, the draft picks were heavily influenced by a 5-year-old girl. So my deck wasn't the best, but we had a lot of fun. But I can definitely suggest anyone who's thinking about drafting for the first time or wanting to improve in drafting, then Arena's the way to go, because not having time picks and, the ability to see your cards as you're picking them online, which is something you can't do, at your FNM. It's a great way to learn. So I've been doing a bit of that and just trying to climb the ladder a little bit up into like gold one at the moment. So seeing what I can do.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
That's good. And as a reminder, while we're mentioning that, we do have a YouTube channel, so you can look us up on YouTube. And that's youtube.com/magicbeanscast, Chewy, I believe.
Yes, it is.
Search for Magic Beans and you'll find us. There's not the good thing with our podcast title, which one day we will explain, is that there's not too many other things out there called Magic Beans. So pretty much anywhere you go, search for Magic Beans and you'll find us.
Including Facebook.
Including Facebook. Yes, we do have a Facebook page. We'll plug all those at the end of the cast. So we've mentioned it a couple of times already. This weekend sees the release of a new Magic set. So we mentioned it on the cast last week. For any non-Magic or entrenched people, Wizards of the Coast does us all a lovely service by printing more cards that we need to buy approximately every 3 months. Which our wives and partners and things like that love when we all go out and buy booster boxes and sit there in the lounge rooms cracking them, things like that. It's always an exciting time, and that release is preceded by a preview season. So we get to, they slowly sort of eke out the new cards that are going to be printed into these sets, so we all get to see them and get excited and have a chat about them and those sorts of things. So there's plenty of other podcasts out there that do set reviews and breakdowns on new cards and go into in-depth discussions and that sort of stuff on the new cards. We're not going to do that. With our once a fortnight schedule, where it's going to take up too much time on the cast. We may on occasion discuss certain cards when we see something cool. This weekend the set releases. So there is a pre-release event when a new set comes out where the stores hold tournaments with the brand new cards that no one's been able to purchase yet. And you get to play in those. So with this release of this new set, there is a rule change that's coming out. So something that happens in Magic is something called mulliganing. When you start a game, you get a chance to do a mulligan. So with this new set that's coming out, there's going to be a new mulligan rule that we're going to have a quick run through of what that is and when that comes into effect and what we think about those changes, because it does have a big impact on the game. We're going to go through that. Joel is going to take us through that. So take it away, Joel. We're going to have a bit of a chat about the London Mulligan.
Yeah. So as Shorty mentioned, the London Mulligan comes into effect when we're recording this tomorrow. So with the pre-release of the Magic 2020 set. And basically what happens is the Mulligan rule has changed so that you always draw 7 cards. So at the start of the game, you shuffle your deck, you pick up 7 cards, you look at your hand, and you decide if it's good. If it's good, you keep it. If you don't like it, you shuffle your cards back in, and then you draw another 7 cards. Now, this is the change that you always draw back up to seven. You look at those cards, and if you decide I can make this work, then you choose one of those seven cards and you put it on the bottom of your deck and you start the game with six. So it's similar to the previous mulligan rule where instead you always go down by one card. So mulliganing is a distinct disadvantage, but instead of having to make a decision based on incomplete information, you will always know what you're starting the game with. So it's quite a big difference in terms of just having a game that functions, right? It's one of the greatest things about Magic is the fact that it has variance, and you never know what the top of the deck is going to deliver you. And you kind of have to balance whether you're playing or drawing first and what you've got in your hand as to whether it's going to be a functional game of Magic. And so you typically look at, do I have lands in my hand? Do I have spells in my hand? Do I have lands that cast the spells in my hand? Scott, not all decks are one color, I will tell you. Mountains and lightning bolts will not always be the formula. It's pretty good.
I'm not playing this game anymore.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was going to talk to you about Boros, which is red and white. We could do that one day. You can put both colors in one deck. But, you know, it's just a matter of, you know, like, it gives you the opportunity at the start of game to make sure that you actually get to play, right? And that's honestly all anyone wants to do. That's why we play Magic, is to play the game. And there have been too many games just ruined by people. There's a term called mulligan to oblivion, right? Where you just go, I have six cards, no good. I have to throw it away. I go down to five cards, no good. I've got no lands. I have to throw it away. I go to four cards. And at that point, the probability of you winning actually just drops phenomenally. Yeah,
it's quite a drastic drop-off. As soon as you go from seven cards down to six cards, the drop-off is massive. And then once you go past six cards, it is your percentages of winning the game are so small at that point.
And we saw a high-profile example of that at a Mythic Championship, or then Pro Tour, when the final game of that tournament was decided effectively by one player mulliganing to four. Yep. So it was a bit of an anticlimax.
And so that was one of the things that kind of spurred this on, was it really became a non-event for that whole climax of that tournament where, you know, basically one person just started the game with, you know, like an arm and a leg tied behind their back. And, you know, it was just not a fair fight in that case. And he was playing the mono white deck, Scott. So there you go. So one of the advantages with, and there are pros and cons with this new mulligan rule, the London mulligan. It's called that because it was tested at the last Mythic Championship, which was held in London. It's something they've always done. Mulligan rules have always been named after the city they were tested in. And so this one will always be referred to as the London Mulligan. And basically, there's a consensus among everybody that for standard and limited, it's amazing, right? It just lets you play really good, fair, grindy Magic. It gives you the opportunity to have, you know, a really good mix of lands and spells, and it gives you the best chance to play the game fairly. When you start talking about some of the older formats, then there are some more interesting conversations to be had. So you look at things like Modern, and of all the other formats that we play, Modern is the one that the beans are probably into the most, apart from Commander and Standard on Arena. But, you know, you start to look at bigger card pools and different kinds of decks, and there are just much more degenerate things you can do. Like, there are some new decks that have been played with now with the release of... was the most recent set?
Modern Horizons.
Modern Horizons, right, exactly. Where, you know, there are now turns and kills available, like, pretty consistently, because this London Mulligan lets you look at all the cards you need, and you can find the three cards that you need to win the game. And you can just, like, insta-kill people with these crazy combo decks. And so that was why they tested it at the London Mythic Championship, which was a Modern Mythic Championship, so the highest level of Magic event you can play. And it tested really well, and people are pretty excited about it. We actually have done a bunch of testing, and we've used it whenever we've got together since they announced it. It seemed like it was going to go ahead. And I mean, from our experience, we all really liked it. We've all been really positive on the impact that it's had, but it's certainly interesting to see how it benefits some types of, you know, some archetypes more than others.
It also benefits the decks that have answers, right? So if you have a deck that is trying to do something degenerate and win on turn two. The deck that you're referring to is a graveyard-based strategy, the Hogak deck, right?
No, so, no, what I was talking about was Neoform. But...
Neoform, right. Yeah. Okay. Okay, sure. Okay, the other degenerate deck,
the,
right?
The other turn two
Grizzlebrand.
Yeah. So what happened in Modern Horizons is they printed a card called Force of Negation, Scott, which is a counterspell that doesn't cost any mana, that you, if as long as it's not your turn. So it also, so the deck empowers those, sorry, the Mulligan rule empowers those decks that are trying to do busted things, but conversely, it also helps the decks that have powerful answers to those degenerate things to find those answers as well. So how balanced that actually is, I guess time will tell, but yeah, I think the fear is that the degenerate decks might have an advantage there.
I think one of the interesting things from the London Mythic Championship, which was a bunch of players who effectively play professionally and who are the best in the world, is that there weren't that many degenerate combo decks that were played there. And usually, you know, pros have a reputation of breaking the format or finding the most degenerate or the most win more strategy. And there wasn't that much at the London Mythic Championship. So I think that boded kind of well London Mulligan rule.
Does and turn I three...
That's how it got put into effect, right? That was really their testing ground of, we're going to release this into the wild and give it to the people who... You know, they're playing for like $50,000 as first prize or something like that. So it is in their best interest to find the most unfair thing that you can do and win as fast as possible. And in them doing so, and, you know, the format not being broken, in air quotes, at that point, I think the humans actually won the tournament, if I remember.
Yes, it did. But I think the...
Really fair deck.
Yeah, but Tron...
Doesn't gain much from that this change at all.
Tron was one of the most represented decks, though, because Tron is it's a mono green deck, but it plays a number of colorless lands that once you assemble the set of three, Urza's Mine, Urza's Tower, and Urza's Power Plant, that's the Urza Tron, those three lands tap for 7 mana. So you can play...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so you can... And it does that consistently on turn three. And you can
the whole deck is built around trying to assemble those three lands so that you can then cast really big stuff way ahead of when you should be able to cast them. So your first couple of turns are spent just searching your library for lands and things like that. And then you hit turn three and ideally you've got Tron and away you go. You cast everyone's favorite card liberated on turn three and take over the game.
So that is in essence... a combo deck in that sense, and it switches gears, but it's a combo deck really, and that is where the pros by and large landed with the deck that would benefit most at that time from that Mulligan rule, and it was represented in the, you know, in the finals and such. So it's whilst humans won the tournament, I think Tron was a the deck that did the best overall.
Not really. If you look at the actual percentage of how it performed in the conversion rate, it actually slightly underperformed what it should have. So, like, yeah, it did just through pure volume put copies into the top eight of the tournament. But people were concerned that, you know, you could basically just guarantee yourself turn three Tron and you know, Khan or whatever, you know, like a big finisher straight away. But it actually didn't kind of, again, break it, which is why we are where we are now. And, I mean, this... has already been implemented on both Magic Online and Magic Arena. And it's the new rule. It's one we're going to have to kind of get used to. And personally, I really like it. Like we've played...
Oh, for sure.
Cube and you know, we sit down and test Modern against each other and stuff from time to time. And it does. It kind of feels like it smooths out the start of the game really nicely. And, you know, there's nothing worse than sitting there with a one land hand going, gee, I hope I get my second land so I can play Magic.
Yeah, there's a very big difference between drawing five cards And yeah, like you said, going, I've got one land. Okay, well, I get to scry. I'm going to keep this hand. I'm going to scry one. That's not a land. I'm going to put that on the bottom of my library and just cross my fingers and hope that next one's a land.
Yep.
Very big difference between that and drawing seven cards and being able to go, okay, I have to put two of these on the bottom of my library. Well, I'm going to keep these two lands and I'm going to keep these other three spells and put these really expensive cards that I'm not going to be able to cast for ages on the bottom of my library and then actually play a game of Magic. So like you said, Cracker, from our testing of what we've played, yeah, it leads to so many more actual fun games rather than, yeah, oh, I got one land and I didn't draw another land for five turns and you beat me, which is not fun for anybody really.
Yeah, it just leads to so many more actual games of Magic. And it's for both sides of the table too. Like, I love the fact that I'm not going to get a whole heap of hands with no lands. And I, like Crack was saying, mulligan to oblivion. But ultimately, we all attend tournaments and events and whatever, or even just hanging out at the kitchen table. We all just want to play Magic. So even when it happens to your opponent, like, it just sucks. And so even for, you know, your opponent having that, it just means you get to play Magic, which is awesome.
Yeah, that's right. I think what the big test will be is since the mulligan rule was tested at the previous Mythic Championship, there has been a bunch of releases and decks like has been mentioned tonight, the Hogak deck and the Neoform decks and things like that. The next Mythic Championship, which is actually in 3 weeks, July 26th to 28th, is another modern Mythic Championship. So there's been quite a lot of speculation, which we won't really go into too much tonight, about potential bannings before then. If the Mythic Championship goes south, there'll almost definitely be bannings after that. But either way, this is the mulligan rule we've got from now. So we all think it's a great idea, and we've seen the benefit of it. We don't play Vintage. We don't hardly ever play Legacy, so those formats aren't a huge concern for us, but the formats that we play the most of, it is a really beneficial thing. So Cracker, when does this actually take effect?
So it actually takes effect from tomorrow, so from July 5th.
Yep. So by the time you listen to this podcast, it is live.
It is the thing that you will be doing.
Yep. So if you are playing a pre-release this weekend, which you've probably played by the time you listen to this podcast, you will have used the London Mulligan rule, and yeah, hopefully it went well and you enjoyed it. But if you didn't get out to the pre-release and you're going to your FNM, then yeah, that's going to be the new rule. And same thing happened the last time they changed the Mulligan rule. There's quite a bit of a period where at the start of every tournament, the judges are reminding you, yep, this is the new rule we're using. If you need help with it, just, you know, put your hand up or whatever. And Arena and Online, Magic Online, they're live now?
They are live now, yes.
Yep, cool. So I haven't fired up Arena since it's been changed, so I'll have to jump on there and see what it's like.
Can I just ask a general question about mulligans? What's everyone's take on when you should mulligan and when you shouldn't?
that's a whole podcast, man.
That is a whole podcast. Yeah,
that's a whole topic.
I can categorically
what you're playing.
I can categorically tell you that people don't mulligan enough. I can say that with authority. Yeah.
So there's no hard and fast rule that says, okay, well, if you've got a handful of lands, only one or two.
Generally, you kind of look at your hand and
it just depends.
Yeah, generally, you look at your hand and go, you know, I've either got one land or six lands. Either of those extremes, you're probably going to want to mulligan it. But if it's two to three lands and some spells, then generally you're okay, unless those spells are 6 mana cost, 7 mana cost, 8 mana cost sort of thing, and then you're not doing anything. So, yeah, the general rule of thumb is looking at, can I do anything with the cards that are in this hand? And if the answer is no, I'm not going to be able to do anything for 4 turns, then you're probably going to want to mulligan it. Yeah. But yeah, we'll do a whole topic on that. If it's not on the list, it should be.
About knowing your role as well, Scott. So like with your mono red deck, yeah, you know that if you don't do anything by turn 3, then you're probably going to lose. Exactly. So it's about understanding, like, what is my deck trying to achieve and how does it go about doing that? And that's probably, and like, unfortunately, experience is the only way. Looking at hands and going, this is great, this is terrible. Whereas some decks just effectively can't afford to mulligan, right? They need every piece of cardboard that they can get their hands on to enact their game plan, which I think kind of segues into our next topic. Chewy's going to have a chat with us about archetypes. Chewy, do you want to jump in and let us know what that means and what there are?
Yeah, pretty good segue. We didn't even plan that one. So I want to talk about archetypes. Part of the depth and diversity of Magic, anyone who's played Magic understands that there's five colors of mana. Wooburg, white, blue, red, black, and the other one?
Green.
Yeah, that other card. I'm like, which one haven't I mentioned, right? And each one of those has like a bit of a core identity, and that core identity tends to lean those colors into a particular type of play. And then if you combine those colors together, so like we've spoken about mono red with Scott's passion for mono red. Mono red in general is, and there's blurred lines either way, but mono red is generally an aggressive deck. So I'll start with what is an aggressive deck. So let's use the current standard metagame, War of the Spark era standard, and essentially the aggro deck is aiming to reduce your opponent's life total from 20 to 0 as quickly as possible. It plays a bunch of cheap creatures. So in this example, we've got the one drop Lava Runners, the Viashino Pyromancers, those 1 and 2 drops. We've got a pretty special card in standard at the moment in the Runaway Steamkin, which is a card that fuels the deck in a different way, but generally it's a two mana cost creature that wants to attack. It gets bigger. That is then paired with direct damage spells. Things like Lightning Strike is your classic 2 mana, does 3 damage to something. And it is, it's a kind of a aggro decks perform a role within any given format of keeping the format honest. You can do some, weird and wacky things in Magic using the interactions between different cards, but there's no point spending 20 turns trying to assemble some, crazy board state when the red deck's going to kill you before you ever get a chance to do that. So, that's the kind of the arbiters of the format, and they are often really incorrectly labeled as easy to play, especially, for people that are new to Magic, they can just, they just threw a bunch of lightning bolts at my face. But the ability to win with a red deck in the face of, a bunch of life gain. So, for instance, the mono white deck that Scott was talking about with lifelink is very difficult for a red deck to win. So those direct damage spells that you have, maybe they're better off pointing at the creature that's gaining life rather than your opponent's face. And there's a lot of decision points. So, the next form of deck, the next archetype, and obviously between these archetypes, the aggro, control, and combo that I'll speak about, there are a number of decks that fit in between those three general categories.
Yeah,
but
a bit of crossover here and there.
Yeah, yeah. And we won't really get into those too much. We'll just talk about the three main ones, but there are definitely examples, and sometimes just the best deck is a combination of the two, but there is... there's the classic mid-range deck, which is halfway between an aggro and a control deck. So an aggro deck wants to attack, a control deck kind of wants to defend. It's a deck that's built on card advantage, which is a concept in Magic where you want to maximize the value of your cards. A classic thing for new players is you'll put a creature enchantment on your creature. So, a Blanchwood Armor on your Galtar, to use Cracker's Daughter's deck as an example. But if I use a single removal spell on that deck, on that creature. I've used one card to deal with two cards. And that's what control decks are built on. They want to use one card to draw multiple cards or one card to deal with their opponent's threats. And then through attrition, they're able to then build an advantage and attempt to dictate the game and the outcome of the game. The decks tend to try to answer the what other cards are being played in the format. So to build a good control deck, you have to have a good understanding of the format. Net decking these days makes it easier there. But for instance, if someone was, you know, playing a lot of a particular card that you know, it worked, one card worked against and not the other, then you know, that dictates your card choices. And they also play generally things that are counter spells, which you try to cast your, you know, your Galta, your Chandra, and they will go, no, I'm going to counter that spell. So that can be frustrating to play against for new players until you learn how to interact with a player with counter spells, and it's something that you level up with as you go along your Magic journey. But yeah, it can definitely be a frustrating archetype to play against for the newer players out there.
And they're predominantly a control deck is some form of blue-based deck. There's very few cards in Magic's history that aren't blue that say counter target spell. So yeah, usually there's some sort of blue, but yeah, it can often be blue-white or blue-white-green or blue-white-black, which is something that's called Esper at the moment, which is extremely popular.
Everywhere.
Yeah, they're almost always some form of blue base in that control deck.
Yeah, and to just dip back into the aggro decks, they're most often either red, white, or green, or some combination of those. There are different times where other colours may have an aggressive slant, but traditionally aggro decks are one of the red, white, and green. Control decks would be traditionally blue and black based. Again, could dip into white, could dip into red. And mid-range decks are generally green-based, but can definitely be any color. The third main archetype, or the fourth, including mid-range, are combo decks. So something that's dear to my heart. I do love comboing people out. What's a combo, though? A combo deck, its whole game plan is to assemble a group of cards, a combination of cards. It could be two cards. A five-card magical Christmas land that win the game. Like, the interactions between those cards win the game. One of the first combo decks in the history of Magic was a card called Erratic Explosion, and it was a four mana red sorcery that says you reveal the top card of your library and you deal damage to an opponent equal to the casting cost of that card. The biggest card at the time that was available was a dragon called Draco, and he cost 16 mana. So the deck played some lightning bolt effects and then the Draco Erratic Explosion combo and could kill your opponent on turn four. So it was a deck that, and combo decks in general, they care about different things. They don't care about creatures in play or generally life totals. As long as they've one point of life, they're still in the game, they can still combo. So they trade resources for cards to assemble their combo. One of those resources could be life. They're often less interactive than the aggro decks or the control decks. So when you play aggro versus classic matchup, you know, aggro's trying to deal damage to the control player. Control's trying to kill the aggro deck's creatures. But combo decks can be a completely different experience. And, yeah, they are an archetype, I'll pick the right word, that often some players really struggle to enjoy playing against. So, control decks can be frustrating to play against, but uninteractive combos can be unfun for people. Anybody who knows me from a Magic perspective will understand that one of my favorite decks in Modern was a combo deck, and it assembled a combination of cards where you could essentially add infinite mana and draw your entire deck and then deal infinite damage to your opponent. So that, but getting to that point could literally mean that your opponent was sitting across the table for 10 minutes while you did stuff like that. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about that because they banned the deck and that still hurts. So it's a really fun thing that you can do in Magic. You can get these strange interactions. The closest thing that we have in Standard currently, I think, the most common thing that you would see, there are some weird combo decks, but the yeah, most...
Just ask Frank Carsten, he keeps putting out all these articles of funky combos in Standard. And, yeah, some of them are quite convoluted.
Yes, but the most common that you would see would be like it's a synergy-based combo where you have in mono red, where you have the
Experimental Frenzy.
Yeah, with Runaway Steamkin, where you can play a whole bunch of cheap red cards off the top of which fuel the Runaway Steamkin, which then you remove the counters from to add more mana to play more cards off the top of the library. So that deck shifts gears a little bit. So it starts off as an aggro deck, but it can certainly assemble a game state where it feels like you're playing a combo deck. So it's a... so that pretty much is my description of the three main archetypes. There are plenty that, as we said, fit in between. So combo control decks could be a deck that, you know, uses counterspells to protect itself while it assembles its combo. The red deck is an aggro combo deck. The mid-range deck kind of would be your aggro control deck, if you like. So it's one of the things that makes Magic great. So yeah, that's does anybody have anything else to add to the anything to add to that as far as the archetypes?
I think mid-range is worth touching on a little more. So mid-range tends to be, as Chewy was saying, green, and quite often, particularly in the current Standard, green-black. And it's a combination of early creatures or early removal spells. So the most recent successful version of the mid-range decks in Standard have been Sultai or green-black, right? And they were using a combination of, like, Wildgrowth Walker as a 2-drop creature, which blocked a lot of the really early aggression from the red decks. And then in conjunction with like Merfolk Branchwalker or some of the other explore creatures to gain life and to grow the creature, right? And so they are looking to kind of slow the game down, but not to the point a control deck does. And they still use all of their cards. And so what happens is they tend to accumulate a bigger board presence than the super aggro decks like the mono red or the mono white decks do, but they're not playing counter spells typically. And then they'll have something big, like they'll have Vivian Reed has been a particularly good finisher for that deck, Carnage Tyrant in recent times, and they'll play these kind of bigger creatures that kind of end the game, and they can lean either one direction or the other, and it lets them change roles in how they're playing. And so if they're playing against the mono red deck, they think, okay, I'm the, in air quotes, control deck in this matchup. So they want to make the game go as long as it can. Whereas if they're playing against like Esper or something like that, then they know they need to continually threaten their life total and, you know, play more aggressively and kind of run things out. So mid-range is a really interesting kind of archetype in that space. It makes you think you really do need to be... very well versed with all the formats, and this is not me by any stretch. It's not necessarily my leaning to play these kind of decks, but you kind of just grind for it, right? There's definitely some interesting thoughts around kind of how that works and being very cognizant of all of what the other decks are trying to do and how your deck can beat them. You're not necessarily looking for any one silver bullet. You're not ever just one card away from winning, but you're just always there exerting pressure on your opponent to make a mistake, and then based on those mistakes really kind of capitalize on them.
Yeah, I think being a slightly newer player, I certainly haven't been playing for as long as Chewy or Cracker or Shorty. One of the ways that it was sort of described to me early on was, you know, your aggressive decks are really looking to win the game in the first 2, 3, 4, 5 turns of the game. And it's at that later kind of 3, 4, 5 turn point in the game that that's when you start to see mid-range and control decks take over. So it was always aggressive decks really need to be winning in those earlier turns of the game. Often if they can't close out a game in those early turns, they're probably not going to win the game. Mid-range, like Cracker was saying, tends to be more, I see that as being a more flexible archetype. It's very, very much able to adapt and put pressure on the board or play a longer game. And control decks, inversely, are looking to really take over the game, what we would call the late game, which is when you start to get past turns 5, 6, 7. And really, they will just take over the game at that point if an aggressive deck or a mid-range deck hasn't been able to take control of the game at that point. So that was always how I'd looked at the other archetypes. And combo is a really funny one where you've got, like we were talking about earlier, some really degenerate combos that can really just go nuts and win the game on turn two. And there's some other combos that take a while to assemble, and they take a bit of a more controlling fashion and win the game later. But that was how I always looked at the different archetypes.
Yeah, it's interesting. The only other thing that I would mention there is that my daughter will watch coverage with me sometimes, right? I'll be watching, you know, whatever's on, you know, Twitch or whatever, and she'll come past and she'll see the life totals. Well, that person is winning because their life total is like 19 and the other guy's at 4. And I'm like, well, that's just not true, sweetheart. And, you know, like one guy will be on mono red and he'll have dealt himself some damage with his own lands or something. And the other guy will be on like Esper control and have reached the point where he's got all of the resources and all of the advantage. And you'll see the mono red player just scoop it up because they realize they just can't do anything to this control player who just, they just want to hit land drops and they want to drag it out for as long as they can. So it's interesting that, you know, like you'll see game states that to a casual player, you go, this person's in control. And if you haven't been watching or understanding what's going on, then like it doesn't actually matter. I remember Jerry Thompson winning multiple games in one of the more recent pro tours at one life against a board state of just, you know, heaps and heaps of creatures. And you would walk past and just go, well, that guy's dead next turn. And the game would last 5 turns and 6 turns. And he would slowly just grind his way through and win. And it was just amazing to watch that he knew what his archetype was and how it played against the other decks. And that was kind of a mid-rangey deck and just, you know, was able to kind of all grind it out. So, yeah, it's fun learning what they do and working out what you enjoy. And that makes change, Scott.
That's definitely a big part of it, is learning a style that you enjoy. And one thing they talk about with the sort of top level pro players is that people should have a good range of decks that they can play, that, you know, they can play the aggro decks and the control decks and the combo decks, and basically they should be able to play whatever the best deck is. It doesn't matter what type it is. But for players like us at our sort of level, play something that you enjoy to play or you enjoy playing, and you're going to be better at it because you're going to enjoy playing it. You're going to want to play it more, and that sort of thing. And, you know, I've played my fair share of ridiculous combos over the years, and most of them are just garbage and don't work, but I enjoy playing them and they're fun. And, you can practice them and learn how to play them, and sometimes you have a little bit of success with them. But I've also played control and aggro and all that sort of stuff over the years. So it's definitely worth learning. But like Joel was sort of just touching on then, it's learning what your archetype is meant to be doing in a matchup. So then when you sit down opposite somebody, if you can figure out, oh, okay, they're playing a mid-range strategy, what are they trying to do? And if you know, okay, mid-range, really what they're trying to do is just go one for one cards for you. You know, you play a creature, they kill your creature. You play another creature, they kill that creature. And slowly, 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 they gain a little bit of advantage, and then they're going to take over the game. And yeah, you might have done 15 damage to them in the first few turns, but you're never going to win that game because they've got to the point where they're in charge of the game. So it's learning those sorts of things. I sit down, I've got this deck, this is what I'm trying to do, this is what my opponent's trying to do, how do I win the game from here, and how are they going to be trying to stop me from winning the game. So yeah, some good archetypes there. Chewy, you got something else?
Yeah, the one of the things that makes Magic great is because there are so many different types and so many possible decks within those archetypes, you can pick up a different deck and play against the same people playing the same decks that you've been playing with for the last day, and the game's brand new again. Everything else is everything else might remain the same, but because you're playing a different archetype, you've got a different mindset, then you're getting a completely new and different experience. And that's one of the things that makes Magic as great as it is.
Yeah, that's right. It's a great game. There's so many different ways you can play it. And the archetypes are just sort of a general overview of the, I guess, the styles of Magic that you can, of decks that you can build when you're playing Magic. So hopefully, yeah, Scott, you got a bit of an idea of the different types. I'm sure we'll be talking about these sorts of things going forward. So when we mention, this is a mid-range deck, hopefully you get a bit of an idea of what that deck is trying to do. And for you, sort of over the next couple of weeks, while you're sort of getting into Arena a little bit more, just try and identify what the decks are that you're playing against. When in the first few turns, look at what your opponent's doing and try and figure out, okay, are they just killing my creatures? Are they doing the same thing as me and just flooding the board with red creatures? Are they countering my spells? See if you can figure out what they're trying to do, what sort of archetype they might be playing, and then mull that over in your brain and go, okay, well, if they're playing this type of archetype, how do they want to win the game? How do I win the game? That sort of stuff. And that will sort of start to lead you down a path of improvement, where you can start getting a little bit better and having an actual game plan in how you try and win your games, if that makes sense to you, Scott.
Yeah. Well, what I have learnt so far is that if I see a lot of blue coming out, I just concede.
you've nailed it, Scott.
Yeah, you do. Turn one island. Oh, no, concede. Done.
I've got better things to do.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that is one of the downsides with Arena is you kind of get a little bit impatient, and you definitely concede games earlier than you would normally, especially playing in tabletop games. So,
but if you win one of those games, Scotty, it is so rewarding.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Yeah, I've definitely had some games where on Arena where my opponent thinks he's got the game all wrapped up and he's giving me the emotes, good game, good game, good game, and then they make one little mistake and bang, they're dead. And it's just like, yep, there you go. You can keep your good game emotes because I just won this.
Sweet justice.
That's right.
If you do concede in Arena, do you still get the XP?
No, I don't believe so with the mastery tree.
That's a shame.
As you get further up in your ranks, you actually start losing rank.
Like Hearthstone.
Yeah.
We don't mention that game on here. That's the forbidden word.
It's just a couple of times last night I had some real trolls, and they were just taking forever. They were clearly going to win, and I was just sitting there. I think I went through three cups of coffee in one game alone. And I thought, I wish I could just concede, but then I think, no, I'm giving up XP if I do that. So.
Yeah, so I think with the mastery tree, which is something we'll look at when we speak a bit more about on Arena, I think you only get experience when you win, and losing, you're not losing any experience. So, if it's a game where you can identify, look, this game, I have a tiny, tiny little chance of winning this game, but it's probably going to take me another half an hour. Yeah, just concede it, whatever, who cares? You could play another five games in that half an hour. So, but when you're making your way up through the ladder and you're getting up to the higher ranks, losing those games does affect you, and you start dropping down the ladder and things like that. So we'll talk about that another time. Cool. All right, so yeah, that's pretty much going to do us for this cast. So yeah, we've had a bit of a chat about the London Mulligan, so we're hoping that'll do some good things for some games. and a little bit of a breakdown on archetypes. So hopefully you've learned something, not just Scott, but also our listeners out there. So if you have learned something, then we would like to get your feedback. So make sure you do hit us up on Twitter. You'll be able to find us at MagicBeansCast. You can also flick us an email, magicbeanscast@gmail.com, or find us on Facebook. Just search for Magic Beans Podcast or Magic Beans Cast, and you'll find us on there as well. Don't forget that we've also got our YouTube channel. Again, search for Magic Beans, and you will find us on there. There'll be a few videos up from Chewy, and hopefully a few from some of the others of us soon as well. This weekend, as we've mentioned, is the pre-release for Core Set 2020, and I believe a few of us may be getting out to some of those. So next time we're on here, we'll have a bit of a chat about our first impressions. But if you can't get out to a store, to your local game store this weekend, there are events running on Arena, and I'm assuming Magic Online at this stage. I don't know who plays that anymore. But yeah, there's definitely going to be pre-release events on Arena, so jump onto those and get into those new cards. And then, yeah, pretty soon we'll be kicking off effectively a brand new standard format, so we might be touching on that in the next couple of weeks as well, what decks we're playing, what we're seeing in the metagame, yeah, and sort of going from there. So any other closing comments from anybody?
No, I'm done.
No,
all everyone good.
Everyone seems happy. Cool. All right. Yeah, well, make sure you find us on those things. If you've found us through iTunes or whatever, please make sure you subscribe. We'd really appreciate it if you did, and spread the word. We are a little startup podcast from all the way down in Australia, so we don't really get the exposure that some of the other big podcasts will be getting. So spread the word. Hopefully we can bring you some good content and you'll keep coming back. And until next time, we will catch you later.